Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted today to be able to speak to Alexandra Jackson of Rathbones, one of the UK's smartest mid-cap investors. So welcome, Alexandra.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for that introduction. It's great to be here with you.
Yeah, well, we had some really positive major economic news last week from the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, and the Federal Reserve, culminating in a sort of Goldilocks US payrolls report on Friday afternoon, which sent stock markets around the world really to the moon. So putting all that together, what's your sort of outlook for equities going forward, particularly in your sweet spot of mid caps? Have we reached potentially a bottom?
Yeah, it was a pretty perfect week last week, wasn't it? But that's come on the back of a lot of very imperfect weeks and it's been very tough the last couple of years, particularly for UK markets, as you say, particularly for SMID within that. I feel quite cautiously optimistic given where valuations are and where fundamentals are. There's a lot to kind of pick through. There's a lot to keep an eye on. But actually, we've been in the eye of the storm for a while now. And for SMID caps, that is quite unusual. Historically, you would find that the FTSE 250 would outperform the FTSE 100 in 3 out of every 4 years. It has quite a high hit rate. Most people will know that outperformance has, been very profitable for them. So 2 years in a row of this underperformance is very unusual. And it's actually given back the last 10 years of alpha. So we've got into this cycle, haven't we, that, I know you've been talking about weak performance, decreasing liquidity, leads to outflows. But look, the recent rally has actually led to a few inflows. We've seen some inflows into the fund. We noted some very small inflows into the UK in general. And I think that's really interesting. We're battling this geopolitical uncertainty, which seems to have become a bit of a norm actually now, deteriorating macro, which will lead to deteriorating earnings. And now we've got this alternative, a credible alternative that we haven't had for a long time in cash rates. But what we're left with now, and I think what we saw last week to a certain extent, was a very low bar for a bounce on, any kind of rate relief. So the Fed not raising rates, the Bank of England not raising rates, and still talking that, hawkish message, but actually they are going to be very data dependent. We see more cuts probably a little bit sooner. November and December also usually very positive from a seasonal point of view. If oil prices, stabilize or don't rally further, that definitely is the wild card. But if oil prices and rates kind of stabilize from here, you could see quite a decent bounce into year end. Over the longer term, for me, it's about valuations, fundamentals, thinking about if we are kind of getting towards the bottom of this, do you want to wait for that final moment? And when is that final moment?
Yes.
Can we pick the bottom? I don't think, we can. I certainly wouldn't profess to know how to do that. But what you tend to find is, and especially we're going to see this now, SMID having underperformed so much recently, but typically we see SMID caps outperforming large by around 17% in the first 12 months of after an equity market bottom. So it's quite hard to time that exact bottom. And if you do miss it, you're missing a huge amount of outperformance. So Sometimes you might have to be a little bit, you know, a little bit early in there.
Yeah. Well, you sound pretty positive there. And is it just for investors interpreting the sort of the recent constant stream, in fact, a bit of a deluge now of M&A, particularly overseas buyers, either trade, you know, sort of like industry buyers, or alternatively private equity, also looking to pick good sort of jewels in the crown from UK PLCs. Is there anything we can read across from that? Because it does seem as though we've had a real pickup of late, which says to me as a sort of dumb idiot sort of investor that prices are still, valuations are still low, and they see a window whereby, as you talked about, you've got to get ahead of this sort of like bounce, hopefully, yeah, sometime next year.
Yeah, I think that's right. And those, you know, kind of long-term private investors are definitely trying to get ahead of that possible bounce, seeing this as a, you know, really nice golden opportunity to pick up, you know, quality, reasonably quality businesses in the UK, which that means they therefore trade on something of a postcode discount. So they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't be able to access those valuations elsewhere. And now that we have more certainty over the terminal rate, you know, private equity companies, for example, they can be a bit more sure about the financing costs they're going to be dealing with. So this is definitely a, you know, a sort of vulnerable time for certain companies. What we've seen so far actually is the majority of takeouts have been in the, you know, quite small companies and names that have been quite vulnerable, maybe a few operational missteps over the last few years. Those kind of names have been the majority that have been taken out. We've had a couple of bids, Decra Pharmaceuticals earlier in the year, that, you know, that is a very high quality trophy asset, and we were very sad to see that go at what we felt was not, you know, not a particularly big premium. But I think that speaks to how, you know, UK investors are, UK fund managers are having to fund redemptions. So a lot of the time they're sort of forced to accept bids, you know, at prices that maybe they wouldn't have a couple of years ago in order to pay that money back. More recently, we've had Ergomed go, yeah, another healthcare business. So they are definitely going. I do think we'll see some, you know, some more trophy assets, some bigger names, you know, really kind of best of breed companies going. And it is, you know, it's interesting. So far, it's been mainly overseas buyers, definitely. Yeah.
Well, it's quite interesting, actually, because one company which has done really well for you over sort of like a long term, Halma, is actually a bit of a buy and build. And it's been benefiting, I guess, over the last 2 or 3 years, because it sort of like picks up really sort of like, you know, industry leading businesses at good valuations that it then improves. And it's in that sort of regulatory equipment services type, yep, business, sort of life saving and sort of fire prevention and this sort of stuff. But it's really niche and it seems to have dominant positions and can really generate excellent sort of like returns. Do you want to take us through your latest views on this? Because it is a real high quality asset. It isn't cheap, but hey, it's sort of like, do you keep it in the portfolio because it's just been a perennial performer?
It's been a perennial performer. The last few months, actually, it's off about 20%, I think, alongside a lot of quality names which have rolled over as we've seen, you know, bond yields rise again, that term premium increasing, which has definitely hit those kind of long duration quality names again. Halma is an amazing business. The way they talk about the Halma way is what the CEO and the previous CEO, who was there for decades and decades, and really, you know, he was really the architect of this buy and build model of finding these niche businesses. You know, it's done an incredible job of turning itself sort of from a accumulator into a platform. And then you plug in these new niche businesses, and the areas they focus on are healthier, cleaner, safer. So as you say, it's sewage treatment, it's fire prevention. They make those machines when you go and have your eyes tested, those awful machines that puff a little puff of air into your eyes to check their health. Machines that I don't like, but absolutely essential. So that's the kind of a flavor of the sorts of things they do. They haven't made any operational missteps, I wouldn't say any major ones. The sort of the curse of being so high quality is the premium rating that you then trade on, and then you know, you really are scrutinized. So any slight, you know, 10 basis points down in a margin is taken, you know, very, very seriously by investors. From our point of view, we can't see any you know, any reasons for the derating. It's the sort of company where when it derates, you go and you check, you you know, you test your investment process again. We've talked to management. We're seeing them again on Friday, actually, a new CEO who was the CFO, really, you know, very sensible, excellent quality. And you go and you retest the investment case again, and hopefully you come out with some conviction and then you can add to it. So when we first bought Halma in this fund, we'd owned it before in other places, but in this fund, we bought it in December 18, when there was that huge sort of quality growth sell-off then. And what we tend to do in the fund during those periods, you know, when markets just go a bit mad and you get these huge dislocations and you get indiscriminate sell-offs, particularly in the UK when liquidity becomes a bit of an issue. And what we tend to do is try and upweight the quality of the fund. So we will rake through the positions again, maybe exit the ones that are the lowest quality in order to have some firepower to buy things like Halma, which are, you know, just, top of the pile in the UK. So that's what we tend to try and do. And Halma, you know, has been a great example of that.
Yeah. And I think really sort of investors, it might optically look sort of like quite expensive, a sort of 23 times PE. But if you put in a sort of 10% organic growth rate, which is what they do, and 20% EBIT margins, then that blows through into 20% increases on EPS. And therefore, your PEG ratio is actually only about one. And that kind of, when you look at it through the lens of a top quality asset globally wise, in the States, it'd probably be valued about 35 times. So.
Yes, I think that's right. And it is the kind of stock where, you know, people say, oh, yes, it has to grow into its multiple, but it does grow into its multiple. And that tends to be fine. Yeah. We've been looking recently at it always trades at a premium multiple, as you say. So is this now an excessive premium multiple? No, actually, the premium to the sector has compressed. Yeah. It generally trades on a 70% premium to the sector, but it is vulnerable to that, you know, quality sell-off that we had over the summer.
Okay, well, let's move on to another sector, but a similar sort of business, Rotork. Lots of IP, has got, again, EBIT margins of over 20%, more cyclical in the power and energy and oil and gas sort of sectors, doing actuators and sort of pumps and stuff like that. What's your latest view of that? Because it did used to be an absolute darling about 10 years ago when oil and gas was going through to the moon. But it's sort of like it's still well priced. What's your latest view on this one?
Yeah, we like Rotork. It's had a nice bounce. We've owned it for a while. We've always, you know, like with Halma, we always want to own those industrial names that have extremely high return on investment. That seems to be the best determinant of share price return, of shareholder return in this sector particularly. So we have this big overweight to industrials, but that's not because we're particularly pro-cyclical. It's because the ones that we own tend to be the, you know, the top quality ones. So Rotork has always generated a best-in-class return on investment. What it hasn't generated a lot of in recent years is growth. So new management team have come in to try and tickle up the organic growth rate a little bit. And the way they're doing that is by focusing a little bit more on the energy transition. So as you say, Rotork make actuators, so essentially the valves, the control mechanisms to control the flow of water through pipes. Actually, the CEO was telling me the other day that the name came from rotator and work. So they smushed those two together, which I quite like. So they make those industrial valves that control the rotational movement. And then the applications are in industrial processes, so rotation work. So they are big into the energy transition, and that should definitely increase the growth rate of the business, because they will be facing into markets that will be faster growing. And actually, the oil and gas market has really picked up again in the last couple of years. So they are they're making great strides there. I went down to see them in the West Country in January of this year, and they were doing a full sort of stock take ahead of putting in a new ERP system. So things like that can really help a company to, they can get a bit closer to their customers, they can organize their inventory a lot better. And that's going to be really important in the sector more broadly as well, watching how that new orders to inventory piece works itself through.
Yeah, energy transition and importantly, energy security is just absolutely front and center of most governments. And Yeah, you're right. All those oil and gas services type businesses are just going gangbusters. So they'll need a lot of the services and products that the Rotork supplies. Now, another one which is, again, been an absolute winner for years and years. It isn't really in industrials, but it's Treat, which does flavours and fragrances for sort of drinks, mainly sort of tea, I think, and things like coffee and alcoholic beverages and stuff like that. Brilliant sort of like, I think it was originally a family-owned company and it sort of expanded abroad. And I think, you've had your eye on it for so long. You've owned it for some time, because I know Lord Lee of the FT likes it as well, sort of stuff. But it has actually slipped up just last year or so. Do you want to take us through your latest as it goes through its turnaround?
Yeah, so we've been watching Treat for ages. It's one of those small, very niche, high quality chemical company. It sits in the chemical sector, but it's not, you know, nasty chemicals. It's natural. They're a supplier of natural ingredients that largely go into drinks. So Red Bull would be a big customer of theirs. The point of Treat is to try and find that nirvana of reducing the sugar content of a drink without sacrificing the flavor. They always talk a lot about mouthfeel. You know, sugar in drinks is not just about the taste, it's also how it feels in your mouth. It works to a lot of different senses. So it's not, you can't just take the sugar out and replace it with a sugar substitute and think that that's going to be okay. As we know, you know, some of the big drinks companies have had a few goes at that. So Treat is all about a kind of a cleaner label, health and wellness, natural flavorings, low calorie solutions. And then recently they've been branching out, as you say, into coffee. So ready to drink cold brew coffee, for example, which has absolutely exploded. Tea as well. What they used to do, the sort of history of it, was trading orange juice. Okay. Citrus flavorings, you know. And that it's, you know, it's just transformed itself. They've got this incredible facility in Bury St Edmunds, which is where they're headquartered. And if you go in there, it feels like a laboratory behind a bar, which is, you know, it's just amazing. So you can imagine these beverage companies going in there and partnering with Treat in order to, you know, really develop their next product. So I think we'll see some, you know, we'll see some really interesting growth out of Treat in the next few years. This new site will definitely help them grow quicker with their drinks company partners. There's been some sort of management upheaval, though. We can't avoid that. The long-standing CFO left a couple of years ago, and when the new CFO came in, he needed to upgrade some of the FX hedging systems. So that definitely caused a bit of an upset this time last year.
That should be temporary,
roughly,
shouldn't it? I mean,
that's temporary.
Just outsource that to an expert who could help you.
And that's exactly what they've done. But, you know, it shocks people when you know, you don't expect that coming out of a company like Treat. It was very highly rated. So again, you know, limited scope to slip up. And then actually, very recently, the CEO has announced his retirement, but we're very happy with the CFO, the new one, who's come from AB Foods, and he will be acting CEO for a while. So there's a bit to, you know, there's definitely a bit to work through. We need to see that growth coming through and this company getting the returns from the incredible CapEx they've put down in this, you know, cool new facility. And we need to see that management change being worked through. And it's a tough backdrop. You know, all the other chemicals companies have had huge profit warnings this year, but actually the flavors and fragrancing piece of those has been fine. But, you know, so it can be a tough backdrop when you're in that same sector.
Yeah. And also, just in the context of that M&A trend, it wouldn't surprise me with two very large European sort of competitors who generate EBIT margins of roughly around about 20%, if they put the slide, because I mean, that's double what these, you know, Treat are doing, but there should be no fundamental reason why they can't. So
scale is very important in this business.
It would not surprise me if somebody now, one which has just spun out of Melrose, and we'll come on to that later, is Dowlais, which is the old GKN automotive driveline business. I think it all does powdered metal components as well, and off highway, and it's really been sort of like, you know, just thrown out with the sort of like the dishwater for ages. And even after last week's bounce, it still trades at sort of 6.5x PE, which looks ridiculous, because it does seem to have a good electric vehicle transition from its sort of constant velocity joint sort of like, you know, products it's sort of like centered on.
Yes, absolutely. So Dowlais has spun out of Melrose in, I think, March, April, earlier this year.
Yeah, that's right.
You often see spin-offs sort of being chucked out with the bathwater. I think that's a good phrase. But we've done some work, or we've seen some work around the subsequent performance of spin-offs. And actually, it's been in the UK market, it's been incredibly strong. So we didn't want to just sort of chuck it out. It does. You're right. It is trading on a very, very low multiple, but you don't tend to see auto component suppliers on high multiples. You know, these are
higher than car manufacturers, though.
Higher, but isn't. not tons higher. Yeah. So yeah, it's okay. Never going to be a kind of 10, 11, 12 times stock.
Yeah, okay.
But there certainly is a lot of scope for this to re-rate. So one of their components, a GKN auto component, is present in one in every two car models. So it has the most incredible position in that driveline technology. As you say, as we move to EV, they are positioned there as well. It's the global market leader. They supply 90% of global OEMs. It is cyclical, though. So as people become concerned about, you know, auto end market sales, you know, Dallas would definitely be a little bit vulnerable to that. So you have to be wary that, you know, it's going to be very cyclical. And then the other thing that's really hurt it has been the auto workers strike in the States with the big three auto OEM manufacturers.
That's over now, though,
but
apparently.
It's now over. So, you know, last week we saw the kind of double rally from the end of the strike plus, you know, the equity market rally. So I think, you know, that's a good signal of what latent performance there could be in Dallas. And as people start reassessing the company, I think it's just, you know, really undercovered, not very well known. There aren't many auto supplier companies in the UK. So you have to, you know, you have to get to know the industry. So I think it's
a global supplier, isn't it? I mean, you know,
it's a global supplier.
Everybody's thought it as a UK business, but actually its biggest businesses are in Europe, the States, and out in Asia.
Exactly. And I think that's what the Melrose, now Dallas, management team can really help them with to globalize the investor base as well, for sure.
Yeah. And I don't think they haven't got a pension scheme either now. I think they're the defined benefit pension scheme. That's been now passed on to an insurance company. So anyway.
Yeah. So they've got a bit of work to do on the balance sheet. You know, it's probably higher than some people would like.
Mm. Okay. Now just moving to another one, AB Dynamics, again, a bit smaller, sort of £330 million market cap company, does sort of all things testing of automotive, etc. Should be more sort of like sort of secular growth, I guess, with EVs, with testing autonomous driving systems and this sort of stuff. What's your latest on this? Because again, it's not cheap, but it's a high-class company with cash on its balance sheet.
Yeah. So, you know, from the very lowly value to quite highly valued.
Yeah.
AB Dynamics is around, as you say, around vehicle testing. So vehicle safety standards are, you know, evolving and moving ahead quite quickly under the Euro NCAP scheme. You know, safety ratings are expected to continue to include more and more around ADAS, crash avoidance systems. There's something called the autonomous emergency braking, autonomous emergency steering developments. Mm-hmm. There could be 700 Euro NCAP test scenarios within two years' time.
Well, for one car.
Across the piece. So there's a huge burden on OEMs, and AB Dynamics has solutions to help OEMs to do that, either remotely or in person, but on a track, so it's repeated very quickly. They have these simulator machines as well that they can sell to other people, but they're quite, you know, it's high capex. So Toyota, for example, will buy one of these simulator machines that works out what happens to the car during certain environments. But they've now, you know, AB Dynamics is a very dynamic business, and they're always looking for ways to increase the growth and to improve the margin in the business. So instead of requiring all customers to buy one of these, you know, £1 million systems, which is a lot of capex, particularly at the moment, that's not a priority for auto OEMs. So now they are sort of leasing, you know, they've put a couple down on the West Coast, and the OEMs can go and book time there. For example, if you don't want to buy a whole one.
And I guess there is a potential upside as well. If ever the regulators decided we don't want self-certification, particularly on autonomous driving or these autonomous driving. We want some a third-party independent assessment, particularly where there's lots of AI associated with it. I mean, these guys are just perfectly positioned to do that, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And the technology they have is absolutely incredible. Yeah. I went down to see them again in the West Country. A lot of these British engineering businesses are based in the West Country. Mm. And we looked at this, you know, if you, to a layman, it looks like an F1 simulator game. But the detail, if the rain comes down on the track, this simulator will show exactly where in the road it will fall and how it will impact the movement and the safety standard of the car. It's incredibly, there's so much IP in this. Brilliant management team in there, particularly CFO, who we've followed her from previous businesses because we know exactly what her playbook is. We know how conservatively she likes to guide the market. Mm. We know that she'll never take any adjustments that could potentially be taken above the line. She'd never take, you know, she'd never mess around with the accounts like that. So we know that even though, it, you know, the valuation is quite high, the multiple is quite high, we know it's a true valuation.
Yeah. Well, I think you might have to forewarn the company the next time they do a site visit. They're going to get thousands of investors like me who are going to pile on there just to go on that simulator.
It's so worth it. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yes, I know. It's only just down the M5 from me. Now, we touched on it. Melrose, the aerospace supplier, which does sort of nacelles for engine covers, I think, and structures. Mm. And I saw this morning they just won a $3 billion sort of 30-year contract with GE Aerospace for their new engines for the GE NX. And this is just like, I think, does it illustrate the sort of the long-term recurring revenues and visibility of their industry? And they're going to be a beneficiary of it.
Exactly. So you've got this double whammy now of aerospace in, you know, structural growth at the moment, huge demand, particularly for narrow body, and Melrose actually talking properly to the market about these risk and revenue sharing partnerships, which help to smooth the cash flow in these engine programs. So the announcement this morning is, another kind of step. I guess I wasn't expecting it so soon, but it's definitely another step in proving out that growth in EBITDA. So they are suggesting that they could almost double EBITDA within a couple of years just from their positions on existing frameworks. So they don't even have to win new business. But I love the fact that this morning they haven't actually upgraded guidance, because they've upgraded guidance quite a lot already this year. But they haven't upgraded guidance this year on the back of this win. So they are still being quite cautious. So I think the new agreement is around new technology, aftermarket repair, and production of fan cases. But the aftermarket repair is particularly profitable for them. And that's what's behind their target of a 30% margin in engines, which is extraordinary. And then when you look at the valuation, you don't see a lot of that reflected. It's got a really nice clean balance sheet now post the demerger. Management change is different. It's a different era. Certainly Melrose is no longer the buy and build, but a buy and turn around and sell model, that it used to be on the UK market, which was very unique and has made shareholders a huge amount of money over the years. This is now GKN Aerospace.
Yeah.
So it is different. But I think, as a listed, independent listed entity in the UK, this share could be very exciting.
Yeah, I would agree. And it really underlines that actually the UK is pretty good at engineering. It just isn't very good at marketing that it's good. That's the problem.
That's exactly right. But we're so good at these niche, absolutely essential bits of kit, but they're quite niche. They're never the biggest bit. They're usually quite a small component. So often pricing power is very good because you wouldn't, redesign your entire product in order to cut the price of one tiny component. We're incredibly good at those, but because they're never the main part, they're never the company on the tin, on the side of the plane or on the side of the bridge or whatever it is, then maybe they don't get the recognition that they would.
Yeah, I think we've just got to be less modest, I think, is probably another one for when it comes to marketing. Now,
easy just on for that, British people.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Now, on that sort of the aerospace trend, obviously, we had Ryanair this morning coming out with an incredible statement saying that it's seen, real strong sales and ticket prices, despite the sort of higher fuel costs. So they've done really, really well, which illustrates they've got, you know, huge demand going through the airports. And I just then let's move to two retailers, which are real specialists, actually, which are benefiting from this whole travel boom over the last 2 years through airports and also through railway stations, if they're open, if there's no strikes, is SSP and WH Smith. Do you want to take us through both of these? Because obviously WH Smith is the more news agent sort of books and snacks, and obviously SSP is the restaurants and coffee shops and things like Upper Crust and stuff like that.
Absolutely. Yeah, so it's quite easy to think of WH Smith as that sort of tired old high street seller of CDs and you know, stationery. Used to spend a lot of time in there as a teenager looking at looking at fluffy diaries and whatever. WH Smith is not that stock at all anymore. Yeah. It is a travel retailer. So companies like Boots, Currys, they have all but removed themselves from the UK airport space. And so now if you want to buy toiletries or electronics in a British airport, most likely you'll be in InMotion for electronics, or you'll be in WH Smith Health and Beauty, which is, you know, totally different. So they have managed to win sites in airports where, you know, previously they wouldn't have been a contender at all. So this business has fundamentally changed. It has a huge US presence now, thanks to a couple of acquisitions they did just before COVID. So quite a tough position to be in at that point in time. But they've really come out of this, you know, roaring. They have this formula. You know, they're really good at encouraging impulse buying at the till, for example, and they can apply it to now a growth market rather than to a market in structural decline in that travel piece. So we see WH Smith as being in its strongest position ever in terms of global travel retailer. And it's all about capital allocation, the way that they take the cash from their high street business and then they recycle it into a growth market. So we're excited about that. It hasn't done very well, I think, because maybe it's slightly misunderstood still. And I think people don't quite believe the recovery sometimes in air travel, that it's happened despite the stats and despite the numbers coming through.
Yeah, I think with investors, it's that important bit you mentioned, which is the impulse, because that means large of its customers are price insensitive, because they're sort of like, you know, they go in there and just fancy having a look around and pick something up, don't they?
Yes, and that's the other one, SSP, which is less on the retail side. It's more, restaurants, food and bev, cafes, bars in airports, and they're not the old, I don't know if you travel through domestic US airports a lot, but they have been pretty dire over the recent past. Yeah. It's a long line of Burger King and Starbucks and it's very, it's quite boring. SSP have really changed that. So they will come in and they'll develop, if they're in a whatever city they're in, they'll take a local, juice provider or a local burger operator, and they will put a concession into an airport. So the airports feel really local. They don't feel, just like any old airport. You could be anywhere in the world. And airport operators love that. It increases the throughput and the profitability for SSP and for the airport operator. But as you say, people are very price insensitive. And I know it annoys me every time I go to the airport and see how much more expensive the sandwiches in Pret are or whatever than they are on the high street. And, shares in SSP are a good way to sort of win some of that back. Yeah. They have some FX, difficult FX exposures, which they need to make sure they're guiding the market properly on. And I think that's been weighing on the shares in the last couple of months as well. But we really rate the management team there. And there's a lot of potential growth in this market, winning share away from also an incumbent who's now quite busy doing working through a big merger of their own. So potentially, doesn't have their eye on the ball. So, SSP could win some more units.
And also, a lot of the airlines, they don't actually, they offer food and drinks, but you've got to pay for it. And therefore, which is even more expensive if you buy on a plane than if you buy in the sort of like the shop. So, there's a lot of people who they're, sort of, as long as you don't take too much, because you get hit by the food and the food bringing it in the following end. But, it means that people, it's cheaper to buying in a shop. And looking at the sort of the margins of SSP and for WH Smith, they're twice as as you know, as rituals, twice the amount of normal retailers, plus with the secular tailwinds of demand. Now, moving on the consumer, we've got Greggs, which is a real best-in-class fast food retailer.
Yeah.
And my only question with Greggs is one valuation. Have we reached peak sausage roll?
We've been saying that for years. We've been asking that for years. Greggs sell 1 million sausage rolls every day in the UK.
1 million a day. Wow. That is incredible.
And what I love about, I don't think we've reached peak sausage roll, because by extending their opening hours later in the evening, you know, they've opened up another avenue of growth, and they're doing delivery as well with Just Eat. And I think they've signed another one of the delivery platforms recently as well.
Deliveroo or something like that, probably.
I think so, yeah. And I've heard a lot of people saying, well, you don't have Greggs for supper. And that's not what they're doing. They're not trying to muscle in on that, you know, a whole pizza delivered, or, you know, a Chinese takeaway or an Indian takeaway. That, you know, they know that they're not the the alternative to a sort of a dinner. They are looking for, you know, it's the after school market. It's the on the way home snack market. They do, you know, you can have pizza and wedges and a drink, so that, you know, they're definitely catering to that, you know, meal. But it's not, you know, I think there was some concern that they were overstretching themselves, and I wouldn't agree with that. There's a Greggs, the nearest place that I could get a coffee from my house is a Greggs, so I walk past it, you know, two or three times a day, and there's always an enormous queue outside. Yeah. And what I love to see now is that the queue is there at 4 o'clock as well. So before, you know, they put the chairs up on the tables at sort of 3 o'clock. It wasn't very welcoming. You wouldn't want to go in and get your, my kids like the donuts, get your donut or your sausage roll. And now actually just extending those opening hours a little bit, you've really opened up a very good extra day part, it's called. So, you know, they're trying to do what they did with breakfast to the late afternoon. So I'm quite excited about that. I don't think we're at peak sausage roll
yet. Yeah, okay. No, I don't think we are as well. I went down to London in the last month a couple of times and went through Euston and Marylebone. This is probably about 8 o'clock in the morning. Most of the food outlets had one or two people getting for a coffee. But the queue going, trying to get in, I mean, it was out the door, miles out the door. And
really?
Across business people, workers, you name it, from the local area, they were just piling straight in. So, yeah, I'm with you. It's going to be 2 million sausage rolls a day, isn't it, by the end of it?
It's an incredible value offer. You know, it's hard to get a hot meal at lunchtime, for example, for that price. Very, very difficult.
Yeah.
And, you know, when it's cold, especially, you know, that does very well. But, you know, again, at breakfast, the value offer is incredibly strong.
Yeah.
And they didn't raise prices as much as other people.
Yeah. Well, you've got another one in the, it's more in the consumer side, on the supermarkets, Tesco's. Now, obviously, this has been around for years and years and years and has been up and down to a certain extent. And it seems as though the supermarket industry is going through a real sort of like, you know, transition, because it had the hard discounts as the Aldis and Lidls taking market share. But equally, it had private equity taking out Asda and Morrisons. And they seem to have taken a step back, particularly on pricing, which has benefited Tesco's and Sainsbury's. And you've had also Waitrose having problems with shrinking. A lot of people going in there and nicking its product, etc. So it does seem as though some of the competitive headwinds have changed tack slightly. And they seem to be doing pretty well, actually, old Tesco's.
Yeah, they are doing pretty well, aren't they? They're the cheapest full-line grocer, so cheaper than Asda, Sainsbury's, Morrison now. This is the most competitive they've ever been relative to their competition. It's the only full-line grocer, again, to gain market share in the last 3 years. So, you know, incredible performance. And they've got the largest market share in online as well. They take 1.1 million orders a week, which is...
I'm a customer. It's very good.
Given how much you hear from Mercado about, you know, their supposed dominance of the online ordering market, you know, actually the narrative when you look under the hood and at the actual numbers is very different. Clubcard has driven a huge amount. You know, those Clubcard prices are driving incredible loyalty in the UK. We actually inherited our Tesco position from Booker. So we were big owners of Booker. That was our largest position actually in the fund at one point, because it had done so well. And then it got bought out by Tesco. And we've just held the shares since then, in, you know, different position sizes. But inflation, you know, inflation is actually very good for the supermarkets. It's a hard message to To talk about in public, and they don't want to talk about in public. And I think they've been extremely responsible about how they've, talked about prices and managed profits. But the bottom line is it is good for profits, and we're expecting more upgrades in Tesco.
Yeah, well, it's good for the customer. I mean, I can't sort of talk more highly about it. So their online delivery is top door. Just on one question, when it comes to the investment thesis, when does it get sort of like, the leverage, the net debt to EBITDA? Because I did notice it's now at roughly around about over 2x, about 2x net debt, which I guess with the higher interest rates will make the interest cover slightly tighter.
Yes, it's not something that worries us too much because of the asset backing in Tesco. Yeah, okay. They own a lot of their stores freehold, so we're not too concerned about that. And they have quite a good plan to pay it down. But you would expect a company like that, which is very, it's not very cyclical, doesn't have a lot of operating leverage in it, that it could carry some higher levels of debt. The other thing that we look at is, alongside the net debt to EBITDA, that ratio. And, I think the ratio that most investors are comfortable with probably come down again. I remember in 2007, fund managers were saying, come on, lever up, gear up, you put another
times.
Turn, put another turn on that multiple, and return it to shareholders, and off we go. And then not 2 years later, they were saying, could you bring that down again? And I think every time we go through a period of dislocation and scare, we say, bring it down again. But alongside that net debt to EBITDA, you'd want to be looking at the term structure of the debt, whether it's fixed or floating, which is really, really important, because if it's fixed, then actually it doesn't really matter, much like the mortgage conversations that we have across the desk and working out whose is fixed and who's in trouble. That's a big portion of the work on the debt side.
Okay. Now, another company, slightly different sector, Future, which was a bit of a darling at one stage in sort of digital advertising. It owns Go Compare, but lots of other Marie Claire and other, sort of frontline, very valuable internet real estate. It's sort of like the industry softened off, obviously, with less digital advertising, but it is dominated by the likes of Google and Meta. And also there's a lot of extra supply coming on from sort of like the streamers and Walmart and people like that. Putting all that into the mix, how does sort of like, what's the future for Future?
So I guess at its core, Future is that content generating business. They have a motto of write it once, use it a lot. So they will, kind of use their content across lots of different places. But it relies on the interaction of customers with the website, the online publications, the events, the magazines. And it's got these 200 brands, and some of the titles are very, very well known. Some are less well known. You mentioned them, Tech Radar, I would put up there as well. But it has suffered from, all of those concerns around Google changing the algorithm. It's suffered from the view that the revenue is maybe not that recurring because it requires customers to, go onto Tech Radar and assess which is the best speaker for the, portable speaker, and then buy it by clicking through into those affiliate links. Those kind of businesses have had a tough time of late. And they've also had a management change again. So, and I think, we can underestimate sometimes the importance of management change in these mid caps, but it does matter, and it does matter around the narrative particularly, which had become very well honed for Future. And as you say, it was a stock market darling. And I think, a lot of those things sort of came together at the same time to create something of a perfect storm. And it was so well owned in UK mid that then those redemptions hit and fund managers, I guess, were forced to sell some of their top performing large holdings. So it got hit then as well. They have recently reported a stabilization in audience numbers, and that's pretty key, having seen a decline in their last interims to March. Now we're seeing a stabilization in audience numbers, a new CEO and a share buyback. So on a mid-single digit PE, that seems like incredible value to us.
Yeah, it is. It's sort of less than 7x PE, no doubt about it. Just in terms of how is it going to be? Is it going to be a beneficiary or potential loser of AI when it gets, sort of generative AI, when they move to sort of internet discovery rather than just straight search?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. People have been talking about that a lot. But, customers want real, correct, well thought out reviews, for example. And AI is you know, often it's learning from the wrong sources. So I think we're seeing a lot more conversation now about publishers ring fencing their digital assets.
Right.
So AI may not be able to learn on, you know, a lot of that content. So there's a lot to work through here. Future as the, you know, as the owner of the audience, they're in quite a strong position there, but it's definitely something that we continue to talk to management about. Watch out for, you know, you get these sort of this hype cycle, and then people actually start to really kind of put the work in to understand how AI might impact, or any new technology might impact each company. But yeah, future's definitely been in the eye of that storm.
Yeah. Okay. Now, another one, which is again was an absolute darling at multiple occasions, is Fevertree, which is the sort of the cocktail mixer, sort of like carbonated sort of drinks, does soda water, ginger ale, and stuff like that. But I think it's all natural rather than sort of like, you know, artificial flavors and colorings and this sort of stuff. And it started off brilliantly in the UK, and obviously it's adopted both off trade and on trade. What's your sort of latest on this one? Because I think it was trading around about over 30 quid at one stage.
Yes, it was. You're right. It is natural. So it was inspired by a particular tree, and the bark of that tree is the source of quinine. And that's sort of where it's...
Where'd they get the fever from?
Well, I think the fever... So malaria would give you fever.
Wow, it's a strange name, isn't it, to call itself Fever Tree? Then, isn't it?
I guess they call it the Fever Tree because you use the bark of the tree.
To
distill the quinine.
Okay. As long as they don't call their products Fever. I don't know, actually. The brand, I suppose, it is Fever. I don't know. Anyway, what the hell?
Yeah, obviously, I think it's based on the tree that helps you with your fever, I guess.
Yeah, okay.
That's what it is. Yes, started in the UK, but now the story really is the US. This is about how strong the US growth could be. They've almost tripled the number of places in the US where Fever Tree sold. So that's off-trade, so excluding bars and restaurants. Tripled the number of places where it's sold in the US, and they've doubled the number of products that they'll sell into each one of those places. So that's laying the groundwork for incredible growth there. They now have the number one position in tonic water and ginger beer in the US, which is, you know, a phenomenal achievement, I think, for them. I looked at the Nielsen data for the last 4 weeks, and volumes were up 14%, and then plus price, total volumes value up 21%. So, you know, this is really strong growth in a huge market. Mm. I saw that one of their NEDs bought £500,000 of stock the other day. They've definitely suffered from, you know, obviously the pandemic shut down the on-trade. But since then, we had a lot of inflationary problems on the logistics side with global supply chains, and also the product cost inflation. So most of the product goes in glass bottles. That's what keeps the premium feel to it. They don't want to put it in plastic bottles. But the price of glass is very linked to the natural gas price. So obviously that went through the roof during the outbreak of the Ukraine war. So they've suffered from a lot of those things. I think we're through the worst of that. And now they're talking about margin upside for next year. And we've got this, you know, the sort of rising tide from great US growth.
Yeah, I'm with you. They make about 12%, I think, EBIT margins. And for this type of sort of coveted brand where consumers actually ask for it specifically, then it should be able to be sort of like, you know, charge get them higher margin with scale benefits, no doubt about it.
Scale, yeah. Again, scale, very important.
Yeah. Well, another one which has sort of come off in the mid-cap space, GB Group, which does all things sort of ID verification, location verification, but should be an AI beneficiary, I'm guessing, through sort of like, you know, regenerative AI, sort of trying to impersonate people and get into bank accounts and this sort of stuff. So what's your latest on this one? Because it's sort of like, during the pandemic lockdown, it was just roaring away, but it's been hit a bit by crypto, I think, and a bit of softness on the gaming side, sort of for signups. But what's your outlook for this business?
Oh, it's one of my most frustrating, disappointing shares, I must say. For a long time, it was my sort of biggest contributor to the performance of the fund over a long period of time.
Yeah.
And we've owned it for a really long time since it was, you know, just teeny tiny, a proper sort of roll up.
Yeah.
And every year they would do a fundraising. And I remember they raised money on the 24th of June, 2016, which, as everyone I'm sure remembers, was Brexit Day. And, you know, there's not many companies who could have raised money on that day that would that would be able to grab fund managers' attention and say, here, come on, you know, think about whether you're going to give us money. So it was always, you know, a real kind of standout stock for us. New management team have come in. They did a big acquisition in November 21 of a US company. They paid 10 times revenue for it, and it turned out that a lot of the revenue was crypto-based revenue. So again, the double whammy of overpaying and revenues then falling away. But the industry, as you say, is, again, in very strong growth, double-digit industry growth, given those structural tailwinds around ID and fraud. The you know, the macro definitely has not hurt them. The has hurt them the crypto and the and the gaming as well, and consumer confidence. But again, I think we're probably through the worst of it. I saw them last week, and they had lots of positive things to say around the growth of the industry and the and what they can do, you know, within it, and also kind of how well placed they are in terms of their products. So the product that we probably all use almost every day is around when you're buying something online and you have to type your billing address and your delivery address in, and it's extremely boring. And you used to have to literally just type in each one. And then you could type in your postcode and do postcode lookup. And that was great. But even that, you know, there was a bit of scrolling and whatever. Now you can just start, you know, you start typing your address and it just fills it in. And I love that. It makes me happy every time. Probably it makes me happy because it, that's GB software and they get paid each time someone uses that. So, you know, you can kind of see why, you can see the foundations of this company and why it would be attractive to an equity market investor. The management team have not covered themselves in glory and have, you know, definitely a bit of work to do to, you know, to improve the rating again. On under 5x sales, it's for an asset like this, though, it's incredibly cheap.
Yeah, it's on 2.7x sales, so very, very cheap. Well, I would say, you know, going back to our original point on M&A, I mean, you know, somebody like Thoma Bravo or the PE house, or, you know, an industry player in this one to do, because these are trophy assets. There's only about four of these ID software businesses out there in the world. Expedia, I think, is another one.
And, absolutely.
And this is 650, and you could just bolt it onto something.
Yeah, it's a little nibble. And I think it does look quite vulnerable now. They were approached by a PE firm last year, and then they went away. So that raised some questions.
Yeah. Let's wait and see anyway. Hopefully they'll do the turnaround and it'll be organic. Now, another one which is in this sort of IT space and digitization, Softcat, which is a sort of like a value-added reseller, helps sort of companies, I think, put in their hardware, but their software implementation, services, training. What's your sort of latest on this? Because obviously they had presumably had a boom time during the pandemic lockdowns. But again, as things move towards the cloud, you might find that middle person type activities are less in demand. I don't know.
So we haven't seen any evidence of that. Actually, the more complicated things become, the more people want that middleman, that advice.
Yeah, okay.
So the point of that value added thing is that, you know, they really hopefully do come into your business. So so Softcat would sell into small, medium sized businesses, also public sector as well. And, you know, if there's one thing I know is that IT is becoming more and more complicated, hardware, software, and the idea of having someone who really knows what they're doing and the training that the Softcat sales guys go through, they're currently being trained on AI, is it's, you know, it's really powerful, and I think helps them to understand their customer, understand what they need, to put in the right solutions. And, you know, they focus on the long term, so they don't want to just focus on this year's win. You know, they're looking to build these relationships with their customers over many, many years. They say that at the moment they only take 20 to 25% of, they call it wallet share, so of what a customer would spend on their type of service. And they've only got 5% in total of the overall market share. So huge amount of growth still to do. They have, you know, very broad range of products, definitely an AI beneficiary. They had their numbers last week, and actually they talked about sales cycles slowing down a little bit, i.e. it taking a bit longer to get customers over the line to make that first purchase. And that has definitely spooked the market a little bit, but I think it was I think it was more about, you know, that sort of travel and arrive situation. The stock had performed very well into numbers. I think it was up 20% year to date. And so any, you know, again, and these things aren't cheap, you know, premium rating, yeah. 20-ish times EV, NOPAT. It's not a cheap share by any stretch. Yeah. But it's got the, you know, these key competitive advantages, the solutions, the capability, the advisory skills. Numbers weren't, you know, no one changed their numbers after last week. We're very happy with Softcat. That to me feels like a sort of machine driven overreaction. And yeah. Actually, you know, Softcat is incredibly diverse in terms of customers, product, technology. They've got a really unique position.
Yeah. Is the same about sort of, Kainos?
Kainos, yeah.
Yeah, which does sort of value-added research, but I think it has an expertise in Workday as well.
Yeah, so slightly different business model. Mm. They don't resell technology. They will help you. Well, half of the business would help customers to implement Workday. Mm. So Workday is that 50 billion US listed
software company, isn't it?
Software company, yeah. It's around payroll software.
Yeah.
And it's quite complicated to implement. So most companies would use, an Accenture or a Capgemini or someone like that to implement it for them. Or you could use Kainos, who are the sort of, you know, slightly more independent upstart. Mm. And then the other half of the business of Kainos is to help the UK government to digitize. So I was doing my mum's driving license renewal online, over 70s driving license that you have to, you know, have a new one the other day. And instead of having to go to the post office and get one of those forms and fill it in and take it back, you can just do it all online now. And it takes a couple of minutes. So it's much better for us. But more importantly, it saves the UK government a huge amount of money rather than having to process these manual forms all the time. And Kainos writes that software, and they're doing lots of work with customs, border customs, lots of different areas, the NHS, DVLA, obviously, Department for Work and Pensions. So they've got these, you know, two very, very different parts of the business, but both driven by a kind of, you know, tech enabled. It's a very innovative work culture, I would say. We were talking to the new CEO the other day about these hackathons that they do. So yes. Employees are encouraged to kind of brainstorm and come up with, you know, solutions to real world problems. I remember the old chairman saying to me, it's harder to get into Kainos than it is to get into Harvard. So they have so many people applying to the company because it's got such great, you know, culture. It's a very exciting place to work. The Glassdoor comments are amazing. Yeah. Again, management change there. So I think one of the best FTSE 250 CEOs that, you know, that I've ever come across in terms of conservative, ability to guide, you know, conservatism around the numbers, plus sort of inspiration, but also really, really humble for a tech CEO, one of the, you know, best performing UK tech companies out there, doesn't always lead itself to humble management teams. And Brendan was extremely, extremely humble. Anyway, so we've got a new CEO, but again, someone who's been in the business for, you know, 20 plus years.
Yeah. Well, it's probably easier getting into Kainos than it is into a Greg's at 8:30 on the railway station, getting your sausage roll is a bit that queue. Now, another one in that sort of sector related, Keyword Studios, which is a sort of like a picks and shovels play on the gaming industry. It's been buy and building, just sort of like localization services for sort of big franchised games, you know, online games, etc. What's your sort of view on this one? Because again, people have been questioning about the generative AI and certainly things like, you know, Microsoft's GitHub Copilot, how that's going to sort of like affect the development and the localization of these going forward, how much sort of like, you know, people work they need.
Mm. I think this is an incredible opportunity in the UK market at the moment. Mm. You know, Keywords is the unsung hero, we call it, of the gaming industry. So they started off as localizing video games. So you can't just translate a game word for word. You need to make sure that the nuance is right, that the jokes are correct for the country that you're going into, all of those things. It's around localizing rather than just translating. So that's its history. And then it's moved into all the other kind of support services. So player support, technical support, and now they do game design, art design, the creative side as well. It's essentially everything. You could cover the full game development cycle at Keywords across their 8 different service lines. They now work with the top 23 of the top 25 gaming companies by revenue, and they've worked on all the top 10 largest games. The AI threat is what's been weighing on the shares this year. Also, the Hollywood writers' strike, which has been, flowing into the gaming writers' strike as well. I think they counter this AI threat quite well. Obviously, they've got huge scale. They've just hired the head of AI from Amazon. So he's come into the business to build, to kind of wrap together all their AI capability within Keywords, make sure that they're doing the right things. You might see a little bit of margin dilution from AI for sure. But, the games companies don't want big parts of their game made by AI. Maybe they'd be happy for, maybe non-playable characters to be made by AI, for the background trees or something to be drawn by that. But customers, players want bigger, more immersive, better quality games. And those have to be made by creatives.
Yeah. Okay, so good.
It should increase the amount of work that Keywords are able to do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's only trading on about 13 times and has got a good balance sheet and generates 15% EBIT margin. So it's obviously doing a lot right and is
it's an incredible opportunity.
Valued at pretty a cheap price with its sort of successful buy and build model, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Another one which is in the healthcare sector, which was doing really, really well and stumbled just of late and now in a bit of a turnaround, is Advanced Medical Solutions, which is a real specialist wound care type business that I think had a few problems out in the States. You want to take us through this one, because it's got a rock solid balance sheet, generates still 21% EBIT margins. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the underlying science, it doesn't seem anyway.
No, again, there's a lot of companies that we've talked about today that have been great for ages and have had operational issues recently, which is, I think, the broader point is around the complexity of the world that we're operating in and the lack of... investors don't give you much opportunity anymore, benefit of the doubt anymore. If there's a small thing that's gone wrong, they shoot first and ask questions later.
I think that's also a reflection of the lack of liquidity, actually, because when I buy shares, it's really tough getting into a stock nowadays because of the liquidity is so poor. Never mind when it comes to selling shares, there's lack of buyers. There's just a lack of sellers as well. So any movement, any bad news is going to be accentuated on the upside and downside.
Yeah, the moves are amplified on both sides. So and investors are looking for a reason to sell, I think, because, if you're facing redemptions, you need to find reasons to sell rather than, in a slightly more proactive equity market, you're looking for reasons to add. So it is a very different mindset. Advanced Medical Solutions is an incredibly high quality, very small, well-run business, same management team for a long, long time. They... manufacture a range of surgical glues, for example. So if your child has not a personal story, I'm sure, but if you've ever taken your child to A&E with a large cut and they don't necessarily want to be stitched up, they might use some surgical glue on that. And they've just released a new product which is XL, so extra large, and that can close a wound up to 60 centimeters, so kind of the full length of your arm, which is, quite groundbreaking. They also have an internal fixation device, which looks a little bit like a hot glue gun. And it, instead of, if you had a hernia repair done in the old days, you would then have a mesh put onto the side, the side of the tissue wall, and that would be tacked in with little staples, little drawing pins almost. Not very comfortable. They're not very secure. It doesn't lead to great patient outcomes. But this glue gun now just puts a little dot of glue in each corner and, leads to much, much better patient outcomes. It's things like that, really innovative, very high IP. But again, this company is taking its products through the FDA for FDA approval. That is not an easy process. And it's a very small company. And the timelines can be, you're not in control of when the FDA says, yes, you can go. So the more products they're able to add into the stable, the better, because they're able to diversify. So they've bought a couple of businesses over the last few years with that, you know, lovely strong balance sheet, that have helped them to diversify the product range. So they've got a nice diversified product range. They've got some good milestones coming up with the launch and regulation of some of these newer products, and you know, evaluation that I think is not not giving you much for you know, for the wound care pipeline, which is the other bit.
Yeah, and wouldn't surprise you if somebody buys these as well. Somebody like Smith & Nephew or something, you know, the perfect sort of like wound care, just because it'd just be a brilliant bolt-on, no doubt.
Yeah, and it's an incredible brand. You know, surgeons that I talk to know, you know, they use and love Liquiband.
Yeah, good. Okay, now just finally come to the last sector, which is sort of property and all things prop tech. We had Rightmove. Their shares have taken a bit of a hit, actually, because CoStar, a big US rival, well, it isn't a rival, but it's a big US player in a similar sort of thing in property, online prop tech, has decided to buy on the market in the UK. And people are thinking this is going to damage its sort of like, you know, its moat. But I was looking at the margins of Rightmove, and I mean, they're just unbelievably 70% EBIT margins. They've got a rock solid balance sheet. And trading at about 18 times, but certainly not massively expensive, but just a huge defensive moat.
Yes, huge defensive moat. So they have a market share of 80%. That means 80% of the time spent on property portals is spent on Rightmove. So, you know, that gives them such a position of power. And you've seen this play out many, many times with Rightmove over the years, where a competitor has come in. I remember years ago when we owned this in the Global Fund, Google decided they were going to come in and do property ads, and the shares reacted very badly. Everyone was very nervous. And Rightmove was able to see them off. Google do not do property adverts in the UK anymore. Similarly, Zoopla, on the market again when they started up, say no to Rightmove. You know, there have been you know, people love to throw stones at the Rightmove model because of those amazing margins and that incredible moat, the returns that this business generates thanks to that monopoly view. So I guess no surprise really that someone's, you know, having another pop at it. I would question what house hunters will get from having to shift to a new platform. So CoStar's buying On the Market, which is the third largest platform in the UK. So Rightmove has 80%, and then, you know, there's a huge gap, obviously, between, and then Zoopla is next, and then On the Market really has, you know, low single digit market share. So they're going to spend a lot of money on marketing, and we know the CEO of CoStar, Andy Florence, from my global days as well. And he is very, you know, he's very bombastic, and he loves to sort of go against the grain. So he doesn't mind that a lot of people think he's wrong. And often that, you know, pushes him forward, and he will, you know, spend even more money, I think, to try and be proved right. We think he might have bitten off more than he can chew this time. However much money you want to push at the marketing side, for house hunters, why would you move to a different platform? You're used to Rightmove. The product is very good. There's no real push, and spending marketing dollars on searches can, you know, push people very briefly to a new website, but it's not going to lead to those leads that are so important for the estate agents. So actually, over the years, you know, it's not traffic that that matters in the market. It's actually the leads that that the agencies get. Thanks to experience and having owned Rightmove for many, many years, and having, you know, known Andy Florence, we are conscious that he is an extremely good operator, and that you don't underestimate him. But I think mainly people underestimate the strength of the Rightmove moat, and that is going to be very, very tough to assail.
They have
a new management team as well, a new CEO, and he's from a private equity background, so has quite a different mindset. Really interesting mindset in how to operate in a potentially a kind of more cost-conscious world. And they're doing a capital markets day in a couple of weeks, so they will definitely talk about this.
Good. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it does look unfairly sold off to me for a real. I mean, this is the highest quality trophy asset you can possibly get with that type of 80% market share.
Now, I think he'd love to have bought that, but you know, it wasn't for sale.
Yeah. Now, to the very, very final, we've got Grainger, which is basically the UK's largest landlord for private rented homes, I think, and has a sort of like a it does a lot of build to rent now, building sort of like, you know, flats and small houses for people to rent out. And then likewise, it's got a big legacy business, I think, that's closed, that's eventually been sold at a reversion. I guess the key, well, the questions here is, in terms of valuation, can you, because it obviously trades at about net assets, I think, does it, can you rely on the valuation of the balance sheet? Is the balance sheet solid enough because of the higher interest rates and valuation of houses and stuff like that? I mean, how do you view it?
Yeah, we still see this trading on a reasonably chunky sort of 20%-ish discount to net asset value.
Yeah.
The structural growth behind it is very powerful. You know, we have a severe housing shortage in this country. It's estimated that we need 4.3 additional homes to plug the current gap, and that actually the supply of new homes continues to reduce. So that's very powerful for incumbents who have a supply of homes, and you can see that in the rental growth that they're able to push through. But they also never, you know, again, they're very focused on the long term. They haven't used the last couple of years when supply was very, very tight, you know, coming out of COVID and rents really went through the roof. They didn't use that to price gouge. They often, you know, sort of took a little bit less in order to preserve the long-term business model. So we love to see that. Great. The product is very cool as well. Another good site visit to go on would be to have a look at a Grainger model. And they take a lot from student accommodation. Don't let that put you off, because student accommodation is, again, totally different to how it was certainly when I was at university. So Grainger have taken some inspiration from that, particularly around the operating platform that they use, and that also helps them to be very, very efficient in terms of vacancies and, you know, turning around tenancies so that they can maximize the profits of the business. So that platform that they use to manage the tenancies is very good. But they've also changed slightly the makeup of the building. So Grainger building now might have the flats might be, you know, buy to rent flats can look quite small, I think, to an investor's eye. You'd have a two bedroom flat, and there might not be much dining space in there. But what a Grainger building will have is a dining room. A sort of communal dining room that you can then book as and when, because most people aren't having dinner parties every night by any stretch. But sometimes, you know, maybe, you know, a couple of times a year, you might want that space. And then they'll have some co-working spaces, those sort of communal areas which take it out of your home. So you can use your home in a much more efficient way, because more people will be working inside their home and living as well. So you can use it in a more efficient way. You know, it just shows how kind of forward thinking they are. They're not just building boxes that suit them and that, you know, cookie cutters that they can optimize for. They're actually thinking how people want to live and how people will want to live. And then they do a lot around energy bills and things like that as well. So you can see how that structural undersupply plus a product that Grainger are providing, which is very, very good, can contribute to really nice, strong rental growth. They're going to convert, I think, to REIT status within a couple of years, so then they'll be able to link the dividend to the earnings stream, which I think will, you know, be attractive to some income investors. Excellent management team there as well. The CEO, Helen Gordon, she's been there for a long time, and she's an excellent communicator and really gives the sense that she's building a business for the long term, which is exactly what we love to see in the UK.
Yeah, I think that's perfect, actually, with the model in terms of young professionals in particular, because if they're working from home 2 or 3 days a week in that hybrid workforce, then having sort of like, you know, office type accommodation where they can work in a very, you know, nice, quiet, maybe even air conditioned environment is perfect, actually. That sort of kills two birds with one stone, doesn't it? You've got your office and you've got your house.
You really have to maximize. People want to maximize their living, and Grainger is thinking like that. Which is, you know, really makes them stand out to me.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. Yeah, okay, brilliant. Well, thanks very much, Alexander. Just before you go, can I just pick your brains in terms of, you know, mistakes that investors sort of try and avoid going forward? Because obviously they can, you know, things like, you know, avoiding companies with dodgy balance sheets and, you know, iceberg type companies and this sort of stuff. What would be sort of the things that you would sort of like, you know, just highlight to investors they should think about before they sort of like do a bit of stock picking?
Yeah, so I think that's, you know, those sort of technical factors around balance sheet, you know, that is definitely going to be super, super important. And as we talked about before, it's not just about looking at the those kind of headline metrics. You want to look at fixed versus floating rate debt, et cetera. The sort of the broader point, I think, and something we try and work on a lot on the desk is around the narrative versus the numbers in UK SMID particularly. This stock market, I think, it grew up with some incredibly charismatic stock pickers who kind of created the market. You know, they grew the market and they brought us all along with them by talking about these stories. And I think that's worked into the psyche of a lot of UK investors. We're looking for the story. And while that can be great, and you need the story to get you excited, increasingly now we need the numbers to match the story. And it can be too easy to get excited about what management tell you and to forget to actually look at the numbers. Are the numbers bearing out what management told us? So that's what we, you know, we're trying to do more in the fund, is to make sure we're not blinded by a good story and ignoring the fact that actually the numbers aren't coming through in the way that we want. So, you know, identify a couple of KPIs. If management say they're going to do this, and then actually next time they say they're going to do something slightly different, or maybe those KPIs just aren't being hit, and there's always a good excuse, but what it adds up to over the years is just a lack of progress. It's not a sort of technical pointer, but it's
no, exactly, combining this sort of narrative with the numbers. It's that sort of classic head, which is your obviously the logic and the rational, and your heart, which is the sort of like in the story and the emotions associated with it. If they both match, then go for it. But if your emotions don't match the actual hard sort of like numbers and the rationale, then you probably need a stiff drink and to rethink it, or a cold bath.
A stiff fever tree.
Or a sausage roll. Okay, brilliant. Well, thanks very much, Alexandra. If anybody wants to invest in the Rathbone funds, how best to do that?
They could come to our website, rathbonefunds.com, and there's some information there.
Fantastic. All right, brilliant. Well, I look forward in touching base in the next 6 months, and hope we're both right in terms of a more positive outlook, but let's wait and see.
Yeah, thank you so much, Paul.
Thanks.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You look amazing. What have you been doing?
You've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, if you qualify, Zelthy providers can prescribe semaglutide, the same active ingredient, at up to 90% less without insurance. Done all online.
No wait at the doctor's office or pharmacy?
No wait. Zelthy can ship the same active ingredients as other expensive GLP-1s to your door.
Get started with Zelthy today for just $39. Call #250 and say keyword care. That's the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less. That's #250 keyword care.